You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
My name is Mwangi Kemenyi, a senior fellow at with the Brookings Institution and the director of the African Growth Initiative. I wish to thank you very much for participating at this event that we have referred to as The Game Has Changed. So it's my privilege to welcome you to this event, and I do hope that you are going to gain from the ensuing deliberations. It seems appropriate to send a particular thank you to Ambassador Michael A. Barrow. Ambassador Barrow has served as a senior advisor to the U.S. Africa Summit at the State Department, and he and his staff have worked tirelessly to make this historic summit a reality. We thank you very much, Ambassador, for the effort and partnership with the Brookings Institution. I also wish to thank Brookings supporters in attendance today, including representatives from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, among others. I would also like to acknowledge members of the Brookings Board of Trustees in attendance. We do have quite a number of senior, present and future, and past senior government officials and representatives, and I wish to welcome them. I also thank all the distinguished panelists for their participation, and we are very pleased that two members of the House of Representatives, Honorable Chris Smith and Honorable Karen Bass, both great supporters of Africa, will be participating in the first panel. I also know that we have many participants from all parts of the world, and especially from Africa, and we welcome you to this event. The game has indeed changed. We have a new Africa, and the focus is no longer clamoring for aid. Today we are talking about investment, entrepreneurship, innovation, and so on. The continent has seen dramatic changes in terms of institutional change, especially as pertains to building democratic institutions. These institutions are not perfect, but are far cry from the days when leadership changes were dominated by military coup. African countries have also institutionalized constitutionalism, still not perfect, but a great improvement. Civil wars still dot the continent, but their numbers, intensity, and duration have subsided. Again, we still have some trouble spots, even today. But the business environment for many African countries has improved greatly, but again, we still need to do more. Most impressive is the Africa growth story. Beyond extractives, oil, diamonds, and so on, African economies are increasingly diversifying and adopting new technologies, and entrepreneurship is thriving. Foreign direct investment is growing, and more important, the sources of FDI are much more diversified. Many countries have realized that Africa is the next growth frontier and have taken strategies to exploit the emerging opportunities. Many have said that Africa is at a tipping point. However, increasingly, many like President Donald Kaberuka of the African Development Bank have warned that we should not confuse a turning point and a tipping point. Africa is not yet at a tipping point, but rather is at a turning point. More needs to be done to reach the tipping point. The Africa Leaders Summit, and indeed this event, will explore priorities for U.S.-Africa policy in terms of business and innovation that are likely to propel Africa towards a tipping point. I would like to make just a few announcements. First of all, we are There are many people on webcasts and others who are here. We are using the Twitter hashtag Africa Summit, and you are free to please use the use that hashtag to communicate, to ask questions, or to comment. Also, please note that we have two tweet screens, which are over there on the right side of the event space, so you can follow the conversation there. These are comments that are coming from outside or here. Again, this event is webcast. It's a public event, so everything which is here is also captured. One of the things that I would like to note is that we actually had so many requests for registration, and we have more people than the room might hold at some point, so you allow us to at least you excuse us for that. We had logistical issues because of the number who wanted to come to this event. So at times we may have people studying and so on. So at this point, I would like to invite the first panel, and this will be moderated by one of our colleagues, Vera Songwe. They are in the holding room, so they should be coming. And there are tables marked AGI. AGI is the Africa Growth Initiative. And if you have any concerns or questions, please contact any of the people at those tables. So as she comes, we have the congressman, congressman and congresswoman in the holding room, so we have called, asked them to join us. As they come in, I would like to introduce the moderator, who is Vera Songwe, an economist. She is a senior fellow, non-resident senior fellow with Brookings, and also the World Bank Country Director for Senegal, Cape Verde, the Gambia, Guinea, Bissau, and Mauritania. Welcome. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Good morning. I think the mics are on now. Thank you. It's great to see you all here for what promises to be an exciting session. The game has changed indeed in Africa. Today we have close to 50 African presidents out of 54 in the state capital for the first U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit, an innovation indeed. The game has changed because today 22 African countries that have performed remarkably and grown sustainably by 4.5% for over 10 years exist on the continent, and we can celebrate them. The benefits from this surge were broad-based, and it's not only resource-rich countries that have demonstrated such strong growth. We have countries like Cape Verde, Mauritius, Mozambique, Tanzania, Ghana, and Sierra Leone that are all among this group of strong and fast-growing countries. The game has changed because there is no longer a debate on the continent about the need for political transitions. There is agreement on the fact that this is necessary and important. Work is needed, however, on how to get the agreement to reality. But a number of countries have already been there and are showing us the light, such as Ghana, Senegal, Kenya, Zambia, Cape Verde, and the list goes on again. The game has changed because on the governance front, as the Moebrahim Index shows, while African countries still struggle with issues of governance, they are making improvements. The Moebrahim latest index of 2014 shows that all countries have sustainably improved on the governance front, even though they are still facing serious challenges. FDI to the continent has increased dramatically from about $33.5 billion to $246 billion in 2012, a 10-year period where it has basically increased that much. And one in every, one can say that the game has changed because even in the US, the decisions and the desire to invest in Africa have gone up. Cumulative FDI stock in 2013 was $54 billion, second only to France. 10 years ago, this was about $7 billion. Countries are moving into the financing space as well. They are improving their credit ratings in Africa. It's making investments on the continent even more interesting. And in Congress, Africa changes the game, which is where we are today. And I want to welcome my panelists. This is one area where the 113th Congress has demonstrated consistent bipartisan collaboration, as is also demonstrated on the panel. The Electrify Africa Act passed the House, sponsored by Republican Royce from California and Republican Representative Engel, a Democrat from New York. The two distinguished House representatives here with us today are also proof of that continuous collaboration when it comes to Africa. Africa unites even the legislators. Despite the fact that Congress is in recess, we were just talking before we walked in about all the events that are going to be held on Congress to celebrate this unique and historic moment, a sign that the U.S. Congress is engaged on Africa and interested in Africa. We are very grateful to have both of them here today with us to talk about the significance of U.S.-Africa Leader Summit and the role of Congress in fostering trade, creating jobs, and improving equality across the continent. My two panelists, first of all, Honorable Congressman Bass, proudly represents the 37th District of California in the U.S. House of Representatives. Mrs. Bass is on the House Committee of Foreign Affairs and is also a ranking member on the Subcommittee on Africa, Global Health, Global Human Rights, and International Organizations, which includes the World Bank and the IMF. U.S.-Africa engagement is one of Mrs. Bass's policy areas, as testified by her presence here today. She supports increased economic engagement with Africa, and the AGOA Trade Preference Program is a key priority for her office. She also runs a popular Africa Policy Breakfast series on the Hill, which discusses various Africa policy issues. She was co-sponsor on the extension of the third-party fabric provision, which was passed in 2012, and a strong advocate for girls, women, and children's issues. Honorable Congressman Christopher Smith, a Republican from New Jersey in the U.S. House of Representatives, is a senior member on the House Foreign Affairs Committee and is a chairperson of the Subcommittee on Africa, Global Health, Global Human Rights, and International Organizations. Mr. Smith also serves as the Special Representative on Human Trafficking for the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe Parliamentary Assembly. He has authored three landmark anti-human trafficking laws, and he is currently leading what I found very interesting, the Increasing Jobs Through Greater Exports to Africa Act of 2013. This is an amazing bill, and I think we should all read it and support it. Before I call on both of my congressmen, thank you again very much for being here, and good morning, to give their introductory remarks, I would like to say that this event also has a hashtag called Africa Summit. And for those of you following us on Twitter, you can submit your questions to this hashtag, and we'll have an occasion to pose your questions to the panel. Thank you very much, and I'd now like to call on Honorable Congresswoman Bass to give her opening remarks.
Wait, do you want me to go to the
podium? Yes, please.
Thank you, Dr. Songwe. Distinguished and honored guests, good morning. It is wonderful to be here with you today on this momentous occasion on the eve of the United States Africa Leaders Summit. Before I begin, I'd like to thank the Brookings Institution for its scholarship and stellar work on Africa, in particular the African Growth and Opportunity Act, ensuring that the many stakeholders of AGOA on the continent of Africa and here in the U.S. are informed about the importance of AGOA for all concerned. And let me acknowledge my colleague in the U.S. House, the Chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on Africa, Global Health, Human Rights, and International Organizations. Chairman Smith and I are from different parties, but the issue of AGOA is bipartisan and bicameral. We concur on the importance of AGOA, and we will both be working to ensure AGOA is reauthorized in a seamless manner. When speaking of this week in Washington, D.C., I use the term momentous to describe the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit, as it is the first such summit between the United States and the heads of state of approximately 50 African countries. I say approximate because I must acknowledge the fact that several heads of state might not be attending due to the deadly Ebola outbreak, and our thoughts and prayers are with them at this time. The summit has, in and of itself, taken the bilateral relationship between the U.S. and the nations of Africa to a higher level. As the first such gathering on U.S. soil, this is an opportunity for the United States and the nations of Africa to address issues of mutual interest and concern. It's also an opportunity for the U.S. to demonstrate its strong and unwavering commitment to a vital region of the world as an inherently strong ally of our country. The time is ripe for such a meeting, and while many will argue that this event should have taken place years earlier, I believe that there is power in the present, and the continent of Africa is arguably at a stronger position economically than it has ever been. In a speech delivered at the U.S. Institute of Peace on July 30th, National Security Advisor Susan Rice noted that in less than 20 years, in the space of one generation, even as major challenges remain, Africa has witnessed remarkable change. Many of us remember this period vividly. It was a period during which Africa was considered to be in a perpetually downward vortex, overburdened by debt, overrun by brutal wars, beset by the HIV/AIDS pandemic, and seemingly unable to address issues of political and economic governance. We remember, for example, the searing cover of The Economist, which proclaimed Africa the hopeless continent in its May 13, 2000 edition. We also remember the December 3, 2011 cover of The Economist, emblazoned with the title Africa Rising, the apparent sea change in the continent's fortunes in a period of little more than a decade continues to baffle many economists and non-economists alike. When faced with information that cites Africa as the next frontier market, with profitable regional stock exchanges and high growth rates that exceed global averages, many observers of Africa tend to fall into two camps: those that foresee Africa growing from strength to strength, and those who see any growth as a short-term anomaly. African Development Bank President Dr. Karuba perhaps addressed this phenomena most succinctly by noting there is now widespread celebration of Africa's performance. For many, it is Africa rising, whatever that means. For others, this is a bubble waiting to burst, a cynical view we've gotten used to. But take a careful, more nuanced look. We are 54 countries with different endowments, starting points, and socioeconomic conditions. Some are endowed with rich natural resources. They export gas or mining products. Others are low-income and oil importers, while several countries are afflicted by conflict. In short, one could argue that there are African countries that fit comfortably into either positive or negative observations. The truth is that while several African countries continue to enjoy unprecedented growth, there are other aspects of reality that need to be brought into the equation, such as the critical need for the development of human capital, as well as the equally critical need for infrastructure development. With a population of 1 billion, Africa is a vast and growing market, a market in which our trade competitors in both Europe and in Asia are actively and successfully conducting business. One resource that all African nations have in common are the youth. The fact that over 600 million Africans are below the age of 35 is a tremendous resource for the continent. It is quite fitting that the precursor to the U.S.-Africa Summit was a week-long conference for the Young African Leaders Initiative. Over 50,000 young people applied to be a part of the initiative, and 500 selected represented every nation in Africa. The leaders have been invited to attend colleges around the U.S. and participate in internships and leadership development activities here and in their home country. The entire world knows Africa's rising, and Africa will continue to rise with the investment in its youth, with the development of its infrastructure, the developments of its 54 economies, and of its democracies. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sanyi, for your very kind introduction, and it's good to see my good friend and colleague, Karen Bass. We work very cooperatively. We work very strongly together as chair and ranking member. My previous work as chair of the committee included Donald Payne. I served as his ranking member, then he served as mine, and together, like Karen and I are doing now, we look for every way possible to enhance the relationship between Africa and the United States to boost health issues. One of the issues, and I will get to the AGOA in one second, but one of the issues that I think is absolutely transformational, and it even has a profound economic component to it, and that is the whole idea of feeding the future, of ensuring proper nutrition for children and for mothers especially, and that the first 1,000 days of life up until the second birthday has turned out to be one of the most transformational ways. Some have suggested that it will add to the GDP of any country about 3%. Because it will mitigate such problems as stunting. It will guard children, especially if they are fed as unborn children and into that second birthday. It'll ensure that their immunity systems are boosted. And added to that, it'll ensure that when they begin to learn, their educational capacities will not be diminished by the deleterious effects of lack of proper nutrition. Many African nations have embraced it. Many still have to, but I do think that is an important issue that we all need to get our arms around and promote as never before. You know, the African Growth and Opportunity Act, as we all know, expires on September 30th of 2015, and the issue of extending AGOA is not in question. The issue of when and how is the big question. AGOA certainly has proven itself. It is still a work in progress. It has had many benefits, although 90% of the benefits accrue to petroleum products and minerals, and that needs to change. A greater market mix, more items need to be not only included, but also those that are already on the list need to be utilized under the provisions of AGOA. It has created about 350,000 direct jobs in Africa. About 1 million jobs have been created that were created indirectly. And in the United States, the estimates are about 100,000 jobs as a result of AGOA. As you might recall, we went through a little trauma recently on the third country fabric extension. It was delayed unnecessarily, and Karen and I had one press conference, one hearing, one statement after another, trying to accelerate the extension. Because what we were hearing from the Africans, and particularly the businessmen and their ambassadors here in the United States, was that don't wait to the last minute, because obviously when you're procuring contracts and creating relationships between other business to business, you've got to have a long lead time. And Congress is notorious for waiting to 11:59 to finally pass a reauthorization of any bill, and the third country fabric extension was no exception. It is for that obvious reason that AGOA should be, if not this year, no later than early next year, reauthorized. And some of the things that need to be on the table as we do that reauthorization would include. As a matter of fact, the AGOA Ambassadors Working Group made a number of very fine recommendations to the United States and to the African countries, including extending AGOA for at least 15 to 20 years so that there's no more of this, will it be extended or will it not be extended? I mean, we, on a related matter, we do the GSP extension. I remember 1 year it went right to Christmas. And there were 120 countries around the world going, well, what are you going to do? And it went right to Christmas when the Senate finally took up that bill. It's usually the Senate, with no disparaging remarks to our friends on the other side of the Capitol. But very often it does take a long time to get these things done. So 15 to 20 years. They want to also, and they encouraged us to enhance political dialogue, more summits, capacity building as a extremely important provision, ensure more U.S. investment. You know, one of the things we all know, AGOA is all about exports coming to the United States. But I've introduced, joined by my good friend and colleague Karen Bass and Gregory Meeks and others have introduced a bill, and Dick Durbin on the Senate side, a bill called the Increasing American Jobs Through Greater Exports to Africa Act. And that legislation will target and try to create a trade strategy for United States exports to Africa. And if we do that, I am absolutely convinced, as are all of our sponsors, that that will create more two-way streets. We also include provisions that ensure that small and medium-sized businesses, especially those that are diaspora-owned, become part of that mix. Right now, they're almost just because of the difficulties of doing business and the distance and a lot of other reasons are not today with their small and medium-sized businesses engaged with commerce in Africa. I think this summit will provide a real catalyst, a launching pad, and I thank the president for convening it, so that ideas like this can take off. AGOA has had great promise, but it is only part of what I hope will be a multifaceted strategy to create that friendship with the African subcontinent, and especially to increase trade and a two-way trade at that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I think we've heard the strong commitment of the House of Representatives for Africa, and especially AGOA, and I think finally this recent act on increasing jobs in America through trade to Africa. I think one of the first questions that I want to ask you is, in addition to putting in forth this legislation, you have congratulated President Obama, but asked him to do more in terms of creating an office with a special representative to push trade on Africa. How does Congress intend to make this a reality and to make it happen? What is the significance of the summit for you in terms of pushing this legislation? You've also talked about AGOA and the fact that one needs to, as we speak, I think the meeting with the AGOA ministers is also happening. How can Congress help to facilitate that and speed it up so that we don't have to wait until the dying minutes? Please.
Well, to start off with, again, this legislation seeks to create a strategy. You know, 3 days ago, the Senate passed a bill that a law that I first did in 2000 called the Combating Autism Act. We changed the name in the most recent iteration to CARES Autism. Contained within that is a national strategy and a coordinator to ensure that the disparate projects, whether it be on helping those with autism, research, are all better coordinated. We did the same thing in a bipartisan piece of legislation on Alzheimer's. Again, different. These are diseases and disabilities, but they are also models. And our legislation on increasing jobs through exports to Africa Act will create a strategy and a coordinator and coordinators. We already have very good people doing this, but just like we learned with the problems after 9/11, when we found that there was so much stovepiping with regards to our intelligence and actionable information about terrorism, we need to have a coordinated strategy, more people. This legislation would deploy, or would authorize, I should say, additional people to do trade inside the embassies. You know, if I'm a small businessman or woman and I'm trying to do business in Africa, where do you begin? Yes, the trade representatives, trade offices, very helpful. But it is very hard. It's a steep uphill climb. But it also needs to be marketed. You know, all of our districts, we have small businesses, right, medium-sized businesses, who today could have a relationship with an African country or countries and be selling their products or coordinating on the importation of African-made products. So increasing rising tide raises all the boats. And I think the more we promote these kinds of strategies, and this idea, this bill, is totally mutually reinforcing to AGOA.
Let me give you an example of the strategy that Representative Smith is talking about. I think the analogy that you used with the Homeland Security is a good analogy, because if you look at the different agencies, departments throughout the U.S. government that have some relationship to Africa, they're kind of all over the place. So one aspect of a strategy would be for there to be a whole-of-government approach to how we deal with Africa. And then if you look inside some of the agencies and you look at their desk for Asia or for Europe, and then compare it to Africa in terms of the staffing and the resources, there's a huge imbalance. So that's an example of what a strategy would do. And then the AGOA forum is happening today. There will be a role for Congress there. I'm sure Mr. Smith will be over there later. We will be. But the big thing we really have to do is push for the early reauthorization. And then one thing that we all recognize from AGOA is that there needs to be a lot more than just AGOA, than just dealing with tariffs. So one of the big things that needs to happen is the capacity building in various African countries. So focusing on infrastructure in a variety of ways. And then Power Africa is an example of infrastructure developing the electrical grid in the continent is a good example of when that comes online, when Africa increases its capacity there, it will certainly facilitate the development of trade.
Thank you very much. I think one issue that we both struggle with in the U.S. and on the continent is the question of jobs. And I think both AGOA and improving exports through this bill are also looking at the issue of jobs. However, we find some challenges, and one of them is the institutions. We've just spoken about creating one focal point. But I think this morning in the Financial Times, there was some talk about Exim Bank maybe being some of the funding being rolled back. How does Congress intend to continue funding some of these strong institutions like Exim and OPIC that are needed to support the capacity building and fund the Electrify Africa Act? And what do you think Congress can do to make sure that these institutions are protected and even probably financed more so that they can help with this great initiative?
Well, the first thing we have to do is make sure that Exim Bank doesn't expire. I mean, that's the first thing. Exim Bank has always been a bipartisan issue, right? And I remember visiting this issue right when I first came to Congress a couple of years ago. We got close to the deadline, but due to the advocacy of a lot of people, Exim was reauthorized. So that's the first thing. We need to make sure that it does not become a political football.
I would agree. A little loud. The Exim Bank has enjoyed for decades a strong bipartisan support, and we always run up the clock right to the deadline. I think it needs, you know, some people mistakenly construe it to be corporate welfare.
Right.
I think it's all about managing risk, and this enables our corporations to do business and to do it robustly by making the playing field, especially with actors like China and others, much fairer for us. So I think it's in absolutely, when you talk about jobs, this creates jobs in the United States as well as helping to foster job creation elsewhere.
This wonderful collaboration that we have here, on both sides, the Republicans and the Democrats, on the strategy for Africa. How do you think we can continue to build this collaboration and make sure that it stays together? What can this summit set in motion so that we make sure that with Congress there is continuous dialogue on Africa issues and that we can have more bills like Power Africa?
My hope is that the Senate will take up the Electrify Africa Act. I mean, Karen and I, it was led by Chairman Royce and Elliot Engel, so the four of us and then many others who followed have all co-sponsored this. Many organizations have endorsed it. It has passed the House. It envisions at least electrifying or bringing electricity to at least 50 million Africans, first time who have never had it. And I don't know how you run businesses. I don't know how hospitals operate. I don't know how you study at night when you can't flip on a switch and get light. So electricity is absolutely fundamental to economic growth and to better health throughout the entire continent. And so this is an idea, as Victor Hugo once said, whose time has come. And in terms of the follow-up, it is my belief that there has been strong commitment to Africa. I mean, President Bush's PEPFAR program was absolutely transformational.
Right.
But it also got many people thinking Africa. Many people then who otherwise had not gone to Africa went and discovered it's just a continent that is surging and it is the future. And my belief is that as the good news about Africa catches on even more, you'll see more businesses, Chamber of Commerce, labor, everyone saying, what are we doing vis-a-vis Africa? Why aren't we including them more? And again, that's why our bill about exports is so important. We want to create jobs in the United States. I make no bones about that. Our legislation, I believe, will do that. But as you create those jobs here and you establish relationships, business is all about relationship and then product. But if you don't have the contacts, you don't have people talking to each other, if you haven't been to country X, Y, or Z, how do you ever, you know, create an economic friendship and cooperation? We do it with Europe. We do it with Canada. We do it with Mexico, which are robust trading partners, those last two more than any other nations on Earth, in part because of proximity. But Africa is not far away, and I think AGOA is a good further launching post. But it has to be better implemented and utilized. And again, the part about workers' rights and other inherent reforms contained in the AGOA language, I think are good so that workers are not exploited. I say with all due respect to the Chinese, they have no qualms whatsoever to exploiting their workforce. I've held 50 hearings on Chinese human rights abuses and several about their exploitation of labor. I have tried for years to get a U.S. Trade Representative, both under Bush and now under President Obama, to look at the unfair trading practices that they routinely engage in, not only occupational health and safety or the lack thereof, but also the issue of not paying people anything close and the illegality of labor unions. I mentioned China because that model, we're in competition with that model of bad governance, both in terms of governments and in terms of trade. And when the Chinese set up a corporation or a manufacturing plant, does not have the same kind of protections. Than we would want to insist upon with regards to the United States.
And one of the reasons why, to me, I promote U.S. business involvement is because we have a history in our country of holding companies accountable. And we also have certain practices here that would not be done in China. So, for example, Mr. Smith mentions the labor issue. Well, one of the things we know about, it doesn't happen everywhere, but China sometimes will bring the labor force with them. And I can't see a U.S. company bringing tens of thousands of Americans to go over to Africa. So our company's ability to go over there and train the African workforce versus exporting workers, I think, is something that is very important for the continent.
Thank you. Clearly, this issue of getting American businesses into Africa is quite important, and AGOA is going to be, I think, one of the principal vehicles. The Obama administration has mentioned that he will ensure a seamless renewal of AGOA. We have this week, I think, African legislatures, heads of states in the U.S. Capitol. How can they help? How can Africa help to ensure that the AGOA bill is renewed, that Exim Bank stays open? What is that relationship? Can we build a relationship that will help ensure that this bill is passed?
Well, first of all, let me do a shout-out to the African Diplomatic Corps here in the United States. They are amazing. We've had dialogues with them on an ongoing basis. We've had press conferences with them. I, myself, meet often, as does Karen, and many of us with their Diplomatic Corps. They are focused. Again, their working group, which put together five major important inclusions for reauthorization of AGOA, I think have enlightened our entire debate on Capitol Hill. So I want to thank them for their leadership. Having foreign ministers, prime ministers, and presidents here and first ladies adds a huge exclamation point to Africa. But the hard work is being done every day of the week by the African Diplomatic Corps. And they have done a magnificent job.
But I do have to say that Chris and I share the frustration that this is happening this week when we're not here. So we have to figure out a way to take the energy and excitement from this week and resurrect it when we come back after Labor Day.
We'll make sure that the diplomats continue. I think before Congresswoman Bass leaves, we'd like to take some Twitter questions. So I think if we've made a collection of them, I'll be ready to take that. Just while waiting, what are the other priorities? I know we've spoken about AGOA, we've spoken about the increasing jobs through exports to Africa. What are the other priorities that you have for Africa in the next?
Well, I personally have several. One of them is the ongoing, overwhelmingly important health initiatives. I mentioned the first 1,000 days of life. In 2010, I joined seven African first ladies in New York for the launch of, and this is their title, the first 1,000 days of life from conception to the second birthday. And the empirical data, and Lancet and others have done yeoman's work on chronicling that if you want a strong and vibrant economy even, you've got to get it right during that critical time. As I mentioned a moment ago, I actually wrote the Combating Autism Act. I'm the prime sponsor of it. Started in 1997. We have just learned from the research that has been done that if women get folic acid and are properly supplemented 3 months before they get pregnant and absolutely in the first month when they get pregnant, the autism spectrum disorder, the ASD, can be reduced by about 40%. Africa has a huge problem of autism. I've been to Nigeria. I've been to a lot of countries. I spoke at a conference 10 years ago on combating human trafficking, and a man came up and said, well, what are you doing about autism here in Nigeria? And I said, nothing. Let's have dinner. We had dinner that night. I've been working on it ever since, and there's probably a couple of million children in Nigeria alone who have autism. And we're not doing enough about it. That not only is a humanitarian issue, because the services are lacking, but if we provide the right supplementation, folic acid especially during the first month of that child's life, 40% decrease, and there's three studies that suggest that's the case. So making sure that these children, and stunting, what a huge problem throughout the developing world, but especially in Africa, and stunting doesn't go away, but it's greatly mitigated when this first 1,000 days of life is embraced and monies flow so that no woman who is pregnant has less than good prenatal and maternal health care for herself and her baby. Secondly, on security issues. On June 4th, in early June, I was in Abuja, and of course the Boko Haram issue and the other issues of security are huge throughout Africa. You know, the rising radical Islamists who target Muslims, and they target Christians especially for killing, we need to collaborate much more on that country to country, particularly when it comes to training countries, vetting them for human rights to make sure that we train soldiers that are believe in the importance of human rights and are not atrocity committers themselves. But that is a major challenge to the whole continent and the world. And then, of course, Millennium Challenge Corporation and all the other economic pieces of that puzzle that will create a huge and positive progress going forward. I mean, I remember I was in DR Congo, and I'll finish on this, some years ago, and I was meeting with a farmer on my way to Goma to talk about the issues related to killings there. And he said, you know, I can grow anything. He had such a great pride in his ability to grow anything. He goes, I can't get it to market. Where are the streets? Where are the roads, the bridges? And of course, Millennium Challenge Corporation is dedicated to that, but I don't think we're doing anywhere near enough to assist in building infrastructure. What transformed America? Our highways. You know, look at the superhighways that were, so you can get goods and products, including food, to market. And in this very Willard, at the end of World War II, it was the American Legion, a member of the American Legion, who wrote on the back of an envelope pretty much, and I think they have a citation somewhere in the hotel where it was done, which led to the creation of the GI Bill. I chaired the Veterans Affairs Committee for a number of years, served on it for 25. The GI Bill transformed America and created our middle class. Maybe that's a strong statement, maybe it's a little overstatement, but it created access to higher education for people in the military, created our junior colleges, and it also had a lot of other benefits, too. And
I'd say, pick on that point and talk about regional integration and the bill that Congresswoman Bass and colleagues are working on, which looks at, I think, during the passage again of this Electrify Africa Act, you talked about 600 million Africans that are in the dark and you wondered how women had kids. But the importance of scale and regional integration, what is Congress doing? What are you doing to sort of maybe help with some of these bills so that they're not just national, but are regional in nature to facilitate that work.
I
will be leaving soon, so maybe we can also use this as part of your closing remarks.
Let me just follow my colleague Chris, because he mentioned health issues, and one health issue that I think is really critical is the maternal death rate. I'm a former healthcare provider, and the idea that women are dying in childbirth in the 21st century is just crazy. And one of the issues that contributes to that is women's ability to space when they have children and how early they have children. So that's one of the big issues that leads to maternal death, and something that I think really needs to be addressed on the continent. But in terms of regionalism, I think it's just really important that when we think about Africa reaching scale, especially to trade with the United States, to the extent that the regional economic communities can come together and resolve issues that impact trade internal to the continent, but also that they begin to come together so that they can reach a level of scale to access U.S. markets is really critical. So in that regard, tomorrow at the Cannon Caucus Room from 9 to 1, we are addressing that issue through a series of panels. We have the leadership from several of the regional economic communities that will be there speaking about the need for integration and talking about their progress and still what remains as a challenge. So I would just like to thank you for the opportunity to come and speak to you today. This is just a very exciting week, a historic occasion, the summit, and I'm honored to be a part of it, and want to thank Brookings Institute for what you do. And I look forward to seeing my colleague as we go from event to event. Like I think we said, there's more than 100 events happening, so I'm off to the next one. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. We've just been handed a question from Twitter. To further help stimulate investment in Africa, what about new bilateral or multilateral investment treaties? What is Congress doing about helping to foster this? I guess this is an AGOA question again.
Or it's a free trade question. My sense is that one of the outcomes, and I hope it's true, will be a focus on some additional free trade agreements. While they're not a panacea, they do create opportunities. We've seen it in the past with other free trade agreements. My hope would be that the labor issues would be robustly included. In the past, that's not always been the case. I believe in free trade, but free and fair trade. Our workers need to, if they are going to be competing against any country in the world, need to have a level playing field, and so I do think that that's an important component. But it's something, you know, one of the things the African ambassadors addressed in their memo to Congress and to all players about AGOA was that there needs to be free trade agreement discussions, but not as part of AGOA, which it wouldn't be anyway, just given the nature of the legislation. But usually it's the president that initiates that. He enters into an agreement, obviously, or a negotiation. I'm not a big fan of fast track, because I think while, you know, if I had the confidence, and I think if others had the confidence, that labor rights would be included. We saw with PNTR with China that China is in a race to the bottom when it comes to exploitation of their labor force. I've had hearings with people who have tried to form labor unions in China who have gone to prison, to the Laogai, have been tortured because they want to form a labor union. And, of course, that's China I'm talking about. But we gave up the leverage that we had with China to promote at least labor rights and hopefully other human rights as well. And we gave them permanent normal trading relations without even an annual review now. They have flooded markets everywhere, made by people in very, very bad circumstances.
On the issue of free trade agreements, yes. A lot of discussion comes about the financing. And as you and I know, a lot of the jobs are created by small and medium enterprises,
right.
And you mentioned that in passing. What more can be done, both in the U.S. and for Africa, to finance small and medium enterprises, ensure that in these trade agreements there are laws that continue to provide resources for small and medium enterprises?
Well, again, you mentioned earlier about Ex-Im Bank and other currently available mechanisms which, again, can't be allowed to expire, and they need to be reauthorized and very, I think, lavishly supported economically, financially. But I think it's more not as much of a financing issue after those kinds of protections, but it's a facilitation issue to make sure that small and medium-sized businesses in the United States, which are the job creators, as we all know in the U.S., 60% of all the exports from the United States are from these small and medium-sized, but not to Africa. So it's a matter of facilitation. One of the things that our bill does, it would increase the foreign commercial service employees to at least 14. That number has been going down over the years. We've got six. That's nothing compared to what ought to be there. And that's just, of course, one of many things that can be done to. But I think open people's eyes to the opportunities that exist in Africa is also a very important. It's still, a great. It's very hidden. People still don't know. And part of what we do in this legislation, the Export to Africa Act, is try to get more of the diaspora who own businesses to form those relationships as a bedrock and core of that relationship, which will be built on by others as well. But there's a special provisions in the bill to trying to facilitate that kind of connecting. It's about connecting.
Thank you. This is why I think the whole AGOA discussion is quite important, because as we know today, Africa exports more to the U.S. than the U.S. exports to Africa, and there is a lot more that needs to be done to balance those numbers. I think the numbers are 39 billion of exports from Africa to the United States and 24 the other way around. We've spoken a lot about the fact that Congress is doing a lot for Africa, but what are the difficulties? Africa is not always number one on the agenda in the morning. So how difficult is it for you to put the African issues on the table, and how much do you think the summit is going to change that perception?
Well, Karen was right when she said, I wish Congress was in session during the summit, but that's House and Senate are both out. And we usually are out right about now, so it's not a surprise to anybody that we're on what we call a district work period. Some say it's vacation. It's not. We do work during the summer months. But Congress is, if it wasn't for the Division of Labor in Congress, it wouldn't be able to operate. You don't need the entire Congress pushing and surging and working on things related to Africa, but you need key players in the Ways and Means Committee, the Foreign Affairs Committee, the Appropriations Committee, Energy and Commerce. And so the key players, the chairman, the subcommittee chairman, the ranking members, are the key to, and of course the leadership, the speaker, the majority leader, of course the rankings on down the line, to making sure that these items are prioritized. And I think the summit will have a truly laudable effect on that, in saying, yeah, these are the problems, these are the issues. My hope is that horrible diseases like Ebola — I'm actually chairing a hearing on Ebola on Thursday. We will hear from Dr. Frieden and others. We didn't do it earlier because we didn't want to come before the summit, but we do have to have a hearing on that devastating disease. But people need to look beyond diseases and say, there's Africa isn't just PEPFAR, it isn't just trying to deal with these crises that the African leaders are confronted with. The best anti-poverty program ever has always been a job, and so if we really want to see Africa continue its rise, because I think it's inevitable, it's a matter at what pace and how many people participate, particularly earlier on. We need these very proactive measures like our exporting bill and of course, reauthorization of AGOA.
I mean, Congress and the work you do depends a lot on the people who put you in power and vote for you. How much do you see a sensibility in your constituents in New Jersey about African issues? And is there, do you get any rewards for pushing the bills that you push in Africa? What is Yes, go ahead.
Well, again, nobody's in this for rewards, and who cares about that? At the end of the day, it's my faith that drives me to do this work. I am a Christian, I'm a Catholic, I believe passionately in the sanctity of life. I believe that we are all created equal, and that government ought to be, can make the difference, in whether or not a society is moving in the direction of justice or in the opposite direction. It does matter who we elect and who we partner with, particularly in some countries where there might not be a elected. That's why I love the conditionality of AGOA in many of these bills to ensure good governance, respect for. I mean, some countries have recently been put back on AGOA. One country was taken off because of worker rights. I think that's a good thing. We signal unambiguously that we care about fundamental human rights. And I think when we do that, we help the average African man or woman and child, and we create better societies. People in my district are supportive. I just got back from, as I said, from Abuja. I wrote an op-ed. I was on a couple of shows. And I did meet with some of the Chibok girls, and I'm trying to promote even more training of human rights vetted Nigerian soldiers to take the battle to Boko Haram, because Boko Haram is on a tear. I was in Jos with Archbishop Kegama and met with Muslims and Christians who are being targeted. And some of the Chibok parents are actually Muslim parents. And I met with one of those dads on the most recent trip. And with tears coming down his eyes, he has two daughters who were abducted. And he just told me how he never sleeps, nor does his wife. So the more we can help out on that. But my point about New Jersey, one of our largest daily papers, when they saw that I had gone, asked that I do an op-ed. I did for the Star Ledger, and it was very well received, even by people who don't normally follow all things African.
Thank you very much. We'll go now to the audience for some questions. I think there are microphones. I can't see with the light here. Thanks, people, ushers carrying microphones around. Please introduce yourself as you ask the question.
Hello, Manya Janowitz from Public Citizen. So U.S. officials have mentioned interest in exploring a bilateral investment treaty with the East African community, but South Africa is currently terminating its bilateral investment treaties after the government's cost-benefit analysis determined that the treaties have not actually increased foreign investment, while they have subjected domestic public interest policies to challenge before extrajudicial tribunals. And also Indonesia, India, and Ecuador, and several other countries have made similar moves. So given the growing rejection of these bilateral investment treaties among some developing countries, do you think that the U.S. government should consider alternative means of boosting investment in East Africa?
I'll take three questions, maybe, sure. And then we'll come back to... Yes, please.
Thank you. My name is Muthaz Modi. I'm of the Nigerian Competitiveness Council. My question is, you spoke about renewing AGOA, and you seem pretty confident. Given the climate here in D.C., do you realistically think this would happen?
Thank you. One more.
Hi, my name is Mike. Excuse me. My name is Mike King. I'm with the law offices of Peter C. Hansen here in D.C. This may not be a separate question, but I wanted to follow up on a question I actually you all addressed via Twitter that I sent out about investment treaties. So it sort of piggybacks on her question. So the question was about stimulating private investment via perhaps new bilateral or multilateral investment treaties. It wasn't necessarily about trade, boosting trade through AGOA, Ex-Im Bank, et cetera. So it's more about zeroing in on stimulating foreign direct investment. What else can be done? Thank you.
Okay. On the first and I guess the third, government has its limitations. What I think we do, and hopefully we will do it, is create a climate, create government-to-government relations that allow private sector to private sector relations to flourish. One of the findings of the African ambassadors was, and this has been found by others as well, is that there's not enough business-to-business contact. Government-to-government can only go so far. There are limitations, but we need to go to the limit of what those limitations are, which is why I think AGOA and all these other initiatives are so important. I do believe that infrastructure remains, if not the key, certainly a key to Africa prosperity. The Electrify Africa Act is just one piece of that. Clean water is another. Waterborne diseases remain. I introduced a bill, for example. Again, this goes to the overriding concern of just helping people to be healthier, but it also means they're more prosperous when they're healthier. And that is the problem of neglected tropical diseases. There's still a billion people who are walking around with parasites and worms. And when we talk about feeding the future and programs designed to feed people, we don't want to feed the worms. And our bill, which we've introduced, would substantially increase our investment and our prioritization of ridding the world of, and especially Africa, of these neglected tropical diseases, these parasites and worms. I remember meeting with a doctor from Ghana who told me that he was meeting with little children. He was working with a lot of, he was a pediatric physician, that a woman brought her son in and said, I think something's wrong with my son. His urine is clear. And she said, all the other mothers say that the urine is red, tainted with red. So that ought to be the norm. Of course, all of those children are carrying parasites within their bowels, and that's the reason for this. He said he was astonished by that statement. So we've had hearings on neglected tropical diseases, and we're going to push forward to get that legislation passed. So facilitation, getting back to what I said earlier, I think is what we can do best. Government can only create so many jobs. We do that here in Washington. We do it in state capitals and municipal governments. But the private sector is where, if a country is going to be prosperous, that has to be built up. Clean water, like I said, is extremely important, and so many issues of that kind. If you get the health piece right, so much more then follows in terms of productivity, people, obviously having a greater possibility of gainful employment. With regards to AGOA, I would, and in terms of these free trade agreements, when countries abrogate or opt out or say they don't want to be a part of it anymore because of human rights conditionality, that's when we should be thinking about doubling down. One of the big problems with NAFTA was that labor rights issues were excluded. They were put on as a sidebar. Same thing goes with CAFTA and some of these other, of course, that's not Africa, but it's a trend with both parties, Bill Clinton, George Bush, that I find objectionable, that we need to have labor rights, at least ILO-type standards, integrated into what we do. And again, for the sake of the worker and for the sake of to reduce exploitation. So I would hope that we would, like I said, double down on trying to say, we want to do trade with this country or that country, but human rights do matter. When it comes to the dysfunction of Congress, as some would call it, there's no doubt that there are huge problems, a large animosity. I've been in Congress 34 years, and I don't think I've ever seen it as adversarial as it is today. I do believe in the two-party system, and benign adversarial relationships are fine. But often it crosses the line, it becomes very personal and acrimonious, and that just means policy goes right out the window. I don't think we will suffer from that when it comes to AGOA reauthorization, but I do think it may, because of past being prologue, mean that we do it later rather than sooner. And that's not good. I think the sooner we get this legislation teed up, all the hearings are held, all the enhancements that might be added to it, adjudicated, the better. Again, for those who benefit, you need a long lead time. And again, that's why the 15 to 20 years recommended by the ambassadors, I think, is a very prudent path to follow. But bills are still being enacted. The Senate, and this is not a partisan dig, but the Senate has held up far too many bills. I have 5 bills sitting in the Senate right now that passed, if not unanimously, almost unanimously in the House of Representatives. But 2 of them have been cleared and are now heading to one on autism and the other on child abduction, international child abduction. It's called the Sean and David Goldman International Child Abduction Prevention and Return Act. That has passed the Senate and is now on the president's desk. But there's far too many other very important bills, pro-growth bills, that languish over in the Senate. Well over 300, I was told recently, and at least 5 of them are mine.
Thank
you very much. Let me take another round of questions, and then we'll use that as your closing remarks when you answer. I don't know if there's any more questions in the audience. Well,
My name is Lamin Drame from BDI, Building Design and International. Talking about development in Africa, we have a major problem in terms of policy and leadership. You have overwhelming number of leaders in Africa. Investors would not want to go there. A, because they feel like they are at risk. What is this core forum doing to help the investors to enable them to go and invest in Africa? Because if you have an investment opportunity, you wanted to invest like 100% of your thing into the country, only 10% will reach to the right investment. If by the time you reach to the investment, 90% of your money is wasted into corruption, bribery, and all kind of things. So I think our leaders need to be sensitized and will be more trained in terms of all those things. Number one, as you mentioned on Boko Haram and other things, I am totally discouraged and disappointed by the president of Nigeria. If President Obama in the United States can swap one military officer with five terrorists, we have over 300 daughters of Nigeria.
Please, because we're running.
Pardon?
Can you ask your question, please, so that we can get the congressman to answer?
Yes. Okay. 300. Three hundred children of Nigeria. They couldn't even negotiate, and they couldn't trace them out. And the world is looking at it. Nobody is making action. It would not encourage any investor to go to the places like Nigeria or in Africa if things are happening there. No solutions has been to the problems. We need to identify those problems which are already out
there.
The
question is, if you may permit, how can we improve security so that we can improve foreign direct investment?
Oh, good.
Ask the congressman maybe to use that. Closing remark.
I do believe that security issues have a chilling effect on some people investing in Africa. They read the news about Boko Haram or Al Nusra, or not Al Nusra, they're in Syria, but some of these other groups, Al Shabaab, and what's recently happened in Kenya, obviously, where they're killing people, including in Nairobi, and it does have a chilling effect. But it also paints a caricature of what is Africa and what these countries are all about. I actually wrote the Embassy Security Act legislation after the U.S. embassies got hit in Dar es Salaam and in Nairobi, for setbacks and for measures to be taken. And in working on that legislation, which did become law, I was shocked at how many people in the business community said, "Oh, now we can't go to Nairobi. Now we can't go to Kenya." So that chilling effect issue is very real. I mean, we have, as we saw in New York City after 9/11, we've had thousands of people, Americans and others, die at the World Trade Center. None of us are safe, but it's a matter of lessening that risk. I do believe that, and I just held a hearing on this, that the training of human rights vetted, and the president did announce a $5 billion initiative for this, and I hope it comes to fruition, to train special forces, again, people who have been properly vetted, to deal with counterinsurgency. I've met Nigerian peacekeepers all over the world. I remember being in Sarajevo during the killing fields in the Balkans, and who was there? The Nigerians. Then I was in Darfur. I met the same major who was at both places, who even there was complaining about his rules of engagement not being robust enough. So the Nigerians and others have stepped up on African peacekeeping. The AU ought to be applauded for the great work they've done in that area. But when it comes to the very difficult dealings of counterinsurgency with groups like Boko Haram, that is a very specialized skill set. We've learned the hard way, and we have people who can train. We just need to aggressively expand that training because as we've seen with the ISIS in ISIS in marching towards Baghdad, where you thought was secure very quickly becomes not secure, and Boko Haram has manifested and done killings, including in Abuja. So there's they need to be the fight needs to be taken to them, but you don't want to put troops who don't know how to deal with that in a situation. You need specialized training. We are training some, one battalion, far less than what's needed. And I think if that gets right, that helps the economic climate as well. Plus, it protects, most importantly, innocent people from that kind of violence.
Fantastic conclusion. We need more trade to get security. Thank you very much, Congressman Smith.
Thank you.
And welcome, Mr. Sahabi.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.